This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Nicola Coughlin, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Youngest Heroes. Rebellion, risk, and the radical power of youth.
She thought, right, I'll just do it. She thought about others rather than herself.
12 stories of extraordinary young people from across history.
There's a real sense of urgency in them, that resistance has to be mounted, it has to be mounted now.
Follow History's Youngest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday the 19th of December. I'm Jane Hill. Lord Peter Mandelson is going to be our man in Washington. The Labour grandee is to be unveiled as the next UK ambassador. We'll ask a former holder of the post what's in store as Donald Trump returns to the White House. Gisèle Pelicot's now ex-husband is sentenced to 20 years in the mass rape trial that's horrified France and the world. Will the case move the dial in the fight against violence towards women and girls? And the newly crowned world's oldest choir. I'll be talking to one of its singers about why he loves being part of it. But we start with the news that emerged just in the last hour or so. Lord Mandelson, Peter Mandelson, is going to be our man in Washington. The Labour grandee served in multiple ministerial roles under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown before taking up a life peerage in the Lords. And he was seen as a key advisor to Sir Keir Starmer in the run-up to this year's general election. This is not Lord Mandelson's first political comeback. He returned to the cabinet several times during the new Labour years, and he had this memorable message when he won his Hartlepool seat at the 2001 general election.
Before this campaign started, it was said that I was facing political oblivion, my career in tatters. Well, they underestimated Hartlepool, and they underestimated me, because I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Well, he will replace Dame Karen Pearce as the UK ambassador, whose term in Washington, D.C. ends early next year, just as a new president enters the White House, of course. On the Laura Koonsberg programme on BBC One last month, Lord Mandelson gave his reaction to Donald Trump's election win.
I thought we were facing a clean sweep for Mr. Trump, and that's what we got. And, of course, being Peter, I immediately thought, well, what does this mean for Britain, frankly? And I thought we're going to be in for a fairly transactional roller coaster ride, but that we have to decide how we're going to influence this presidency, what we're going to put into it, and what we're going to get back from it.
Well, let's talk first of all to Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt, who is with me. He used the phrase roller coaster ride there. That's a bit like his own career.
It is indeed. I mean, I think what we're talking about is the fourth comeback over a quarter of a century. And it's interesting you played that famous fighter, not a quitter clip. That, of course, was the 2001 general election. That was about 6 months after he'd had his second unfortunate departure from the cabinet. And then 3 years later, he had another comeback when he was appointed by Tony Blair as the European Trade Commissioner.
Yeah, and you've known him for, am I allowed to say, decades?
Yeah, they're getting on for 30 years. Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk in a moment to a previous incumbent in the Washington job. But your thoughts as well, Nick, about his personality, his skills, and how those are going to be put to use, because it's a heck of an in-tray, isn't it?
Well, at one level, you could say it's a bit of a curious appointment to put such a tribally Labour figure in to be ambassador to a presidency that is on completely the opposite side of the spectrum. But I think that Downing Street are looking at two big things about Peter Mandelson. The first thing is he's just a very significant, giant political figure. He holds his own. I think they're interested in that. And the second thing is trade. Trade is clearly really important. This afternoon, the Prime Minister was talking about how he is worried about Donald Trump's plans to impose tariffs. The Prime Minister says, I don't like tariffs. Peter Mandelson, he's been the UK Business Secretary twice. He was the European Trade Commissioner. And the point about that post is you are the negotiator for trade on behalf of the whole European Union. In other words, on behalf of around about 500 million people. You are a really big figure. And I remember I was in Brussels for The Guardian then. You'd be sort of chatting to him and then he'd be texting. Who are you texting, Peter? You'd say, oh, I'm just texting the Indian Trade Commissioner. He used to find himself in the Elysee Palace. He could hold his own. And I think what they'll be interested in Downing Street is that Keir Starmer says he wants to ride two horses, close trading relationship with the EU, close trading relationship with the United States, and Peter Mandelson has been talking about how we should, the famous Boris Johnson phrase, have our cake and eat it.
Nick, we will see. Thank you very much, Nick Watt, Newsnight's political editor, of course. And as promised, let's talk then about what the coming months and years may hold. Sir David Manning joins us, UK ambassador to Washington from 2003 to 2007 and now director of Gatehouse Advisory Partners. Sir David, hello. Very good evening
good
to
evening.
You. First off, I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, I think the Prime Minister's chosen somebody who is obviously very close to him. He has his confidence. I think that's very important for the job in Washington. And as others have already said on the programme, he has this huge trade experience, and that's going to be a crucial part of the portfolio.
I mean, do you think that is one of the key reasons that he was selected, a former EU trade commissioner and more besides?
Well, I think that the trade element in the relationship is obviously going to be critical. We don't know what President Trump will do. He has said he's going to impose tariffs. We're hoping to avoid the imposition of tariffs on our exports to the United States. We have in Peter Mandelson somebody who knows the trade dossier exceptionally well. And he's also somebody who is a tried and tested advocate. So I'm sure the Prime Minister thinks that he will be somebody who will be able to make the British case in Washington extremely effectively, and all the more so because he comes, as your earlier correspondent said, with the reputation of a very big hitter politically and somebody who is very close to the people in our own government.
Yes, I mean, those are the sort of CV elements, if you like. People will also be really interested, though, in the diplomacy. That is the job. What do you make of him personality-wise? What will he bring to it in that sense? Because you have met him, you do know him.
Well, my experience of him when I was ambassador in Washington at that stage, he was, in fact, the EU trade commissioner, was that he was immensely effective. He's a very articulate, highly intelligent, extremely experienced operator. And I'm sure that the government's calculation is that he will be very effective in trying to get alongside the key people around Trump, as well as the president himself. And that is what he will be sent to try and do.
Given all of that, though, and we've talked a lot about trade and tariffs already, obviously, how much influence, though, can an ambassador have in those sort of fields? I mean, I'm not trying to do down in any way the role you once held, but those are technical discussions unpredictable times come January. How much influence can an ambassador really have?
It's a very fair question, and a lot of it turns on personal chemistry at both ends. The ambassador tries to be, if you like, a conduit between the president and the prime minister and the foreign secretary, tries to be part of the debate at both ends, tries to have the confidence of his interlocutors at both ends. And much, as I say, depends on the chemistry that there is. It is going to be difficult. I mean, let's pretend, you know, there are all sorts of issues that will be contentious and difficult for any incoming ambassador to handle. It's not just trade. We don't see eye to eye, as far as we know, with the Trump administration, because so much is uncertain on all kinds of issues, from probably the Middle East to climate to how we handle China. So there's a huge intray here, and a difficult intray. But I assume that the Prime Minister and David Lammy, having looked at this, will have concluded that, you know, given that the challenges, the uncertainties, the volatilities that we face, that Peter Mandelson is a very good person to choose to try and manage these.
So, David Manning, very good to have your thoughts. Thanks for joining us so quickly here tonight. That's very good of you. Thank you.
I'm Nicola Coughlan, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Youngest Heroes. Rebellion, risk, and the radical power of youth.
She thought, right, I'll just do it. She thought about others rather than herself.
12 stories of extraordinary young people from across history.
there's a real sense of urgency in them, that resistance has to be mounted now.
Follow History's Youngest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Still to come here on The World Tonight, the 90-year-old chorister who's broken that world record as a member of the world's oldest choir.
Most of the people in the homes have got similar problems. So you're meeting people with similar problems to yourself, but with a similar interest, that being choral music in particular.
That's coming up later. Before that, though, graffiti has sprung up in the streets around the courthouse in Avignon. Some of it translates as "Gisèle, women, thank you." That gratitude and admiration is for Gisèle Pelicot, a 72-year-old grandmother, now an icon, a beacon of courage, after she waived her right to anonymity at the trial of her now ex-husband. He was jailed today for 20 years after drugging and raping her, and for more than a decade inviting dozens of strangers to rape her as well. 50 other men, the youngest 26, the oldest 74, were all found guilty of at least one charge. Their prison sentences range from 3 years to 15 years. At the end of today's legal proceedings, Gisèle Pelicot made this statement outside the court.
C'est avec une profonde émotion que je m'exprime aujourd'hui devant vous. Ce procès a été une épreuve très difficile.
It is with deep emotion that I speak to you today. This trial has been a very difficult ordeal, and at this moment I'm thinking first of all of my three children, and I'm also thinking of my grandchildren because they are the future, and it's also for them that I fought this battle, as well as my daughters-in-law Aurore and Céline. I also think of all the other families affected by this tragedy. Finally, I think of the unrecognized victims whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know that we share the same fight. When I opened the doors to this trial on the 2nd of September, I wanted society to be able to debate the issues it raised. I have never regretted this decision.
Well, there have been many, many supporters outside court for her during this trial. Today, they cheered as her ex-husband, Dominique Pelicot, was sentenced to those 20 years. But others chanted shame and justice. There was anger that some of the sentences were less than prosecutors had demanded. Well, let's talk to Kim Wilshire, who's a freelance journalist based in Paris, who has sat through many days of the court hearings covering the case for The Guardian and The Observer. Kim, good evening to you.
Good evening.
So much of the evidence in this 3-month-long trial has been so disturbing. Just, if you can, just give us a sense of your thoughts now that it's over about everything you heard and saw.
Well, it's been 3.5 months of the most appalling evidence, really. I don't think any of us who've sat through it can unsee or unhear the things that have been said. It's been such a level of depravity that it's been very, very hard to listen to, and also to understand what Gisèle Pelicot has been going through.
Yes, and the fact that there were so many other men on trial, that her now ex-husband had been able to recruit so many men from a relatively small area.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is one of the enduring questions of this trial. How was it that Dominique Pelicot was able to, within a radius of 50 kilometres around their home, able to recruit so many men who were willing to come and rape and sexually abuse his wife, who, it was very clear very early on in the trial that there were attempts made to suggest that Gisèle Pelicot was perhaps complicit, that she was, that she had somehow known what was going on. And anyone who saw any of the videos that were shown in court very, very quickly realised that that she was totally unconscious, inert, and was being treated as her one of her lawyers said to us, you know, as not just nothing, but less than nothing.
And given that, Kim, there's been a lot of anger about some of the sentences, particularly for those 50 men. Explain a little bit about the disparity. I mean, the sentences go from 3 years to 15.
Yes, well, the three-year sentences were for sexual abuse. There were 47, all of the men were convicted. They were found guilty of at least one charge, 47 on charges of rape with aggravating circumstances, two for attempted rape and two for sexual assault. So the lower sentences, I think there was just three years and 4 years, were for sexual assault. I think the problem was that the maximum sentence that could be given to Dominique Pellicot was 20 years. And so we had 51 rape trials in one here. And so the other sentences were sort of shuffled down a bit. I mean, they were less, every sentence was lower than the public prosecutor had requested.
And let's talk about consent within French law, yes, because from where we sit in this country, it seems as if there's a lot of debate about that law, the fact that consent isn't referenced in relation to rape cases. Actually, from where you sit in France, is there a lot of public debate about that? And is there any optimism that that law could be changed?
Well, yes, there is. This is the big question. And I think there are a lot of people that want the law changed, and we have a window. There is a window, thanks to this case, if anything good can come out of it, for that change to happen. There are MPs in the National Assembly who have suggested, even though last year it was first suggested, so perhaps this trial will be an impetus for change. At the moment, rape in France is an act of penetration that involves violence, constraint, threat or surprise. And these charges were sort of shoehorned into the surprise category. But, you know, a lot of people are saying that that France needs the same, I think they call it the only yes means yes sexual consent law that we see in other European countries.
Kim Wilshire, thank you very much for joining us from Paris. Well as those calls for this case to result in that change in the wording of French law around consent, there's also a broader call, a call for a shift in attitudes around how women are viewed and treated by men. I've been talking to two survivors of sexual assault. Bénédicte Martin, the writer who's been a high-profile member of the Me Too movement in France, and here, Johanna Robinson, who's the National Advisor for Wales on Violence Against Women and Girls, who earlier this year spoke publicly for the first time about being raped by someone she knew when she was in her 20s. First, I asked Bénédicte, what does she think of the sentencing today?
For me and for lots of people in France, 20 years for Dominique Pellicot is not enough. It's a maximal in France, but it's not enough.
This has reverberated so strongly in France. Could this begin a debate about the need to change the law, and particularly around the issue of consent?
Yes. So lots of feminist associations in France asking for a new law, a bitter treatment at the police station, a special court for sexual cases. And we need that government give us some money. We need to put the notion of consent in the law, because during the trial, some lawyer said there is rape and rape. Mm-hmm. If you rape without thinking you're raping, you are not a rapist. Mm-hmm. So Giselle answered at this time, no, there is just rape.
Johanna, the focus is on France for obvious reasons, yeah, but I think women everywhere assume that we can't think that this only happens in France. This could happen anywhere.
Yes, I think it resonates internationally, sadly, doesn't it? So many of the issues that this has demonstrated and that Madame Pellicot has shown to be the truth and the challenging truth exist. You know, the whole thing about shame that she has said, you know, shame must change sides. Shame is held by every single survivor everywhere. It's what stops them coming forward. And she's done this so bravely, hasn't she, to encourage other people to come forward.
And you have spoken, Johanna, very openly mainly about your own experiences in that regard.
Yeah, so for me, both as somebody who I didn't get anywhere near court, it was stopped at the police stage. The amount of evidence that you need to have, you know, we have between 1 and 10% of cases, reported cases, actually reach conviction in court. So there has been much talk about the decriminalisation of rape, and I don't doubt that's an issue in France as it is here as well, which is hugely hard to bear as a victim, as a survivor. Most people, much as Madame Pellicot in this case, wanted to stop the perpetration. Most victims come forward because that's what they want, not just for themselves, but for everybody. That was my motivation. I didn't want him to get away with it. So I didn't care about my own sense of justice, but the fact that if somebody else came forward, I wanted to have that evidence available. And like in this case, you know, we hear of the neighbour was one of the perpetrators. In my case, it was somebody that was known to me. That's really, really common. And then that plays into things. How could somebody like this have done this to you? Because we think it would be somebody strange, somebody wild, somebody who's violent and who's aggressive. And it normally isn't that. And that's really hard for us all. You know, we hear 1 in 4 women will have experienced sexual assault or rape. As in this case, these 51 men came from across society. And this is the reality in France. It's the reality here. It's the reality internationally.
Talk to us, especially given your role advising in Wales there, talk to us about the role of men and how important it is for men to speak out about this, not just women.
We've done a lot of work in Wales about trying to engage men and boys. We know that many will turn away from this, that they will see this as a slight upon them. So that if we talk about how frequent, how common it is, it becomes an argument about, well, it's not all men, but it's many men. If there are 1 in 4 women who have these experiences, then there are men who are perpetrating this. Many of them will do it repeatedly. It's hard for us to know who is good because it's very ordinary people. Mine was a very ordinary man who did it to me. It is so, so common. And what we need is men to step up.
Benedict, I'm interested in your take on that. I mean, I can't ask you to speak for the whole of France, but are you able to give us a sense of the reaction to this case within France on gender lines? Have you seen men in public life decrying what we have all been watching and listening to in the last few weeks?
No, in France, I've seen no men talking about this. It's in the newspaper, yes, of course, but we have nobody in the government, nobody important or famous spoke about this case. And I really don't understand. I really see myself living in a really misogynist and machist country.
Johanna, I could hear you wanting to come in there. What's your thought on that?
Well, it's hugely sad, isn't it? This hugely brave woman has stepped forward on behalf of so many women. And if we don't have men recognising the devastating experience that she's had, without them, it is very hard to get progress.
And Benedict, you were sounding downbeat, I think, about whether this could usher in some sort of change. You talk about a misogynistic society where you live in France. Is there anything to take from this that's positive? Is there any change in discussion attitudes that could come from this case?
Yes, I think Giselle showed us today how make it. For example, today she took off her black sunglasses she wore every day before. So for me, it's really symbolic. We can see her eyes now, and she can see the light. It means she doesn't need protection anymore. I think it's positive because by this pink scarf she wore, full of colors, she said, okay, Giselle, I've done it. Everybody can do it now. And I think lots of women now will go to the trial without fear.
Johanna, your experience of sexual assault, you've been very open, was in your early 20s. A while ago. Does this case say to you that society hasn't improved since then?
Yes, and I didn't report it for 27 years. I tested the system, you know, kind of more currently than when it occurred. The system, it hasn't changed enough. As in this case, the evidence has to be irrefutable beyond all doubt. And we know that the doubt that is cast within these kind of cases and the terrible experiences that victims have to go through in this, we owe them more. We owe them justice. And we know that people will come forward. We know that it is the efforts of victims, of survivors coming forward, that push criminal justice forward.
Johanna Robinson and Benedict Martin. And do just let me tell you that if you have been affected by the Pellico case, if you're impacted or someone you know is impacted by sexual abuse or violence, there is lots of information about help and support on the BBC website. The full address is bbc.co.uk/actionline. Now, if you have the BBC News app on your phone, you'll be used to this sound. That is a breaking news push notification from the BBC. But recently, some people with newer models of iPhones received an alert that said this.
Luigi Mangione shoots himself.
Well, that alert wasn't true, of course, because Luigi Mangione, who's been charged with the murder of the health insurance company boss Brian Thompson, did not shoot himself. That alert had been created by generative AI, artificial intelligence. Apple has now been urged by the journalism body Reporters Without Borders to scrap this new feature. And the BBC had previously complained to the technology giant about that inaccurate headline. So how was that news alert created? And should tech companies be using AI to generate news? I asked the technology journalist Kate Bevan.
What's happened here, I think, is that ChatGPT has sucked in all the news headlines for the past few days. And what it's done is it's churned out what it thinks is a headline. But I think the thing to really remember with generative AI, with ChatGPT, is that it's not a knowledge engine. It has absolutely no understanding of the words it's ingesting and of the words it's creating and outputting. What it's doing is it's working basically like a giant autocomplete. So like when you text a friend and, you know, your phone suggests the next word, that's basically what it's doing, but on a much bigger and rather more sophisticated scale. So it's imagined, it hallucinated, as we say in AI, this headline. And Apple News pulled that in and sent it out as an alert. And it was completely made up.
And so journalism bodies are right, surely, to sound alarm bells about this, because it was false and it was wrong. But it could have been about something even more worrying, or it could have been libelous, or it could have been factually wrong about public health issue. I mean, there's a million scenarios where that is very worrying, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's incredibly worrying. I mean, one of the things we always say for any of us who work with AI is that you absolutely must have what's called a human in the loop, i.e. humans involved in it, in everything, checking the outputs. What prompts have been used to generate these outputs? What do the outputs say? Are they accurate? Could they be misleading? Are they wrong? And to check them before they go out. So this was clearly an automated process. ChatGPT did a scan of the headlines and decided this might be a headline and just spat it out, and nobody checked it. I mean, that's actually a very old-fashioned thing. You know, you should always check anything before you hit the publish button, whether you're a human or a machine.
How do we stop that happening again, though? Or how does Apple stop it happening again?
Apple needs to put some humans on that process. I mean, AI is great for automating all kinds of tasks, and I think that's what, you know, we will increasingly see it being used for. What it's not great for is writing copy that goes out without somebody checking it. And when you combine automation with writing copy and nobody looks at it and goes, hang on, is that right, and checking it, then this is when you're going to get this kind of problem. So, you know, if you don't have that human quality control in the process somewhere along the line, it's going to happen again.
In years or decades to come, could we be seeing a point where actually it has learned it won't make those sort of mistakes, and actually therefore generative AI could end up being used to write some journalistic copy that today is done and checked by humans?
I think it's getting better, but I think also we are going to see the big public models like ChatGPT, like Bard, like Hugging Face, actually get less and less useful, because what they're being constantly trained on is more and more AI-generated stuff. So, no, I don't think it'll ever be good enough to use without humans in the loop. I mean, you can come back to me in 20 years' time if I'm still alive and go, no, you were wrong.
Well, that's a relief for all of us for now anyway, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, I think there are some unscrupulous content mills that are going to do it. But, you know, they exist anyway, with or without AI.
The technology journalist, Kate Bevan. The UN-sanctioned stability mission in Haiti was meant to be a multinational effort involving 2,500 soldiers from 7 countries led by the Kenyan police. 6 months after it was meant to be operational, only 400 Kenyan police officers have been deployed, and the mission remains seriously underfunded. The BBC's Nwala Magafi spent time embedded with the Kenyan forces before heading into gang territory.
Driving through Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, in an armored vehicle, we witnessed the aftermath of the daily street fighting between gangs. Burnt down cars, tanks toppled over, and ransacked neighborhoods. This used to be one of the most populated areas of the Haitian capital. It's now a ghost town. We're joining the Kenyan police on a patrol. It's not long before we come under fire. Just meters away, a human body is burning in the middle of the street. Haiti is a state on the brink of total collapse. Crippled by natural disasters and poor governance, violent gangs that control much of the country are terrorizing its people. There are over 100 of them operating in Port-au-Prince. We're going to meet the leader of one of the largest gangs. Renald Destina, who goes by the alias Tilapli, leads over 1,000 men. His gang, Grand Ravine, is notorious for kidnapping.
I want to ask you about all the young men that are coming to fight with you. What is it that motivates them?
I am the one that's saving them from famine. The government doesn't create any job. It's a country with no economic activity whatsoever. Even the school system is almost non-existent. It's basically a failed state.
Back in the street, the Kenyan police are doing what they can, but they're overwhelmed. Commander Godfrey Atonge is optimistic, despite the challenges.
As at today, the population were demanding they wanted now our team to extend and go to other areas and pacify. There's overwhelming support and the population are very happy.
So you came here 6 months ago with 400 of your officers. You were promised 2,500. 6 months on, no one's been deployed. Why is that?
I can tell you that MSS is a unique mission. It has never been done the world over. This is the first of its kind. And anything new comes with challenges. That one we have to accept. My president, His Excellency the President of Kenya, pledged that he's going to bring to Haiti 1,000 personnel.
But they were meant to come in November. They still haven't come.
Very soon, before the end of December. The issue is about the process.
A long and painful process, especially for the 760,000 children in Haiti, NGOs say are facing acute malnutrition. In the only public hospital still operating in Port-au-Prince, we meet Venda. She avoided taking her two-year-old daughter to the hospital, fearing the violence in the streets. She prays it's not too late.
I would like my kids to be able to eat bread, even if I can't. I would like to get proper care for my child too. I don't want to lose her.
We reach out to the Haitian government, but they didn't agree to an interview. Human rights agencies and several international actors are now appealing to the UN to turn the Kenyan-led mission into a full-fledged peacekeeping operation. This would mean more money and more resources. But political instability in recent weeks resulted in even more violence than usual, pushing another 50,000 people to leave their homes. And it's hard to see where it all ends.
Nuala Magavi there in Haiti. Now, residents of a group of care homes in the West Midlands, average age 92, have set a Guinness World Record for being the world's oldest choir. They were awarded their certificates this afternoon after performing at a concert in Stratford-upon-Avon. I've been talking to Chris Wrighton, who at the age of 90 is one of the choir's younger members, and Jasmine Kessie, deputy manager of one of the homes involved, who set up the choir.
Our voices ring like holy bells. It's Christmas through the years. It's Christmas through the years.
So we came up with the idea of building a choir, and we got all of our region's homes involved in this choir. And we were practicing initially over Zoom calls, and it was going really well. And then I thought, you know, we might be the world's oldest choir. So we had a bit of a research and we saw that it's quite possible that we were the world's oldest choir. We've been practicing every Wednesday and it's just been really great.
And how many members, and do you have to audition or is it for anyone? How does it work?
No, it was open to anybody that wanted to do it. It was completely free to whoever wanted to come along and sing, really. There was no auditions or anything like that.
Who gets to decide which songs you practice and what kind of music you're involved with?
That just came together as a group. We asked the residents what they wanted to sing, what their favourite songs were, and it all just came together that way, really. A lot of them love Away in a Manger and Daisy Daisy and things like that. You know, quite recognisable songs that didn't need much practice, and they all just got together and it came out.
Together we've nothing to fear. Our voices ring like holy bells. It's Christmas through the year.
So Chris, tell me what you like about being part of this choir.
Well, it gives us the opportunity to meet people from other homes. I mean, most of the people in the homes have got similar problems. So you're meeting people with similar problems to yourself, but with a similar interest, that being music and choral music in particular. So that's where I think the interest came from. But it really comes from a desire to go on meeting people, even in our dotage. And when the thought was put in front of us that we might actually attempt a world record, first of all, we thought it was a bit of a joke. And then later on, we realised it was serious. And now that we've achieved it, it really feels to be quite something.
They have an official average age of 94, making this a new Guinness World Records title. Congratulations.
Oh, how will you celebrate?
Well, I gather there's some pop about somewhere. I've yet got to find my share. I should probably find somebody else has had it by the time I get to it. And then I think it's fish and chips on the way home.
And have you always been musical all your life?
I've always loved listening to choral music. I never performed music because I was doing other things. And so it was a bit of a challenge for me. And I'm pleased to say that it's all been worthwhile, very worthwhile.
Do you have a very good voice?
No, not particularly. But of course, in a choir, there's always somebody to cover you up if you go wrong. And we all did a bit of that for one another today, I think. But no, I wouldn't want to perform as a solo performer.
And I think you had a very special guest, actually, today at the big ceremony where it was announced that you were indeed world record holders.
Yes, we did. We had Tony Christie, who sang Amarillo. And
did he sing it for you today?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Fantastic.
And that was also quite something to appear on the same bill as him.
Jasmine, I do want to come back to you because it's lovely. You can just hear in Chris's voice what it means to him and how much people are obviously getting out of the choir. What differences have you perhaps seen it make?
You know, you see a lot of times people are very anxious to come into care homes, very nervous about it. And one thing that they tend to do is isolate themselves away because their bedroom becomes their comfort zone. So by doing this choir, we've managed to get people out of their bedrooms. They eat better. They socialise with each other. It's just been really lovely to see everybody come together as a community. And like Chris said, we get to meet people that are in similar situations and can share those experiences as well.
Yes. And is it going to keep going, do you think? Has it been such a success?
Yeah, absolutely. We're not going to give up now. I've heard mentions of Britain's Got Talent next year, but we'll see.
Chris, what do you think of that idea of Britain's Got Talent? Are you up for being on that?
Well, that depends. We all are, of course. But yes, whatever the home organises, I'm sure they'll find people to participate because, you know, this will be put up in front of them as something outside the home that will interest them and give them an opportunity to do all sorts of things. And having achieved a little bit of success, they'll probably be looking for even more. And so, yes, I'm sure we should be up for it, but whether we're going to be able to do it or not, it remains to be seen.
Well, that's a lovely way to end my last World Tonight for 2024. I'm Jane Hill. So it's Happy Christmas from me, from the whole team. Good night to the rest of the team. Back with you tomorrow at 10, of course. Good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.